words. Tough love from a man Dom revered. The truth set in. Like so many present and future CEOs, he had succumbed to identity theft. His corporate identity, his hyper-focus on the work, had subsumed his humanity. It happens all too easily and leads to problems that get magnified the further you climb. If you become a hollow husk of a human, you burn out fast, but that's not the worst of it. You can't lead effectively if people don't see signs there's a person behind the title. Protect your identity from theft. Invest time in nurturing aspects of yourself that are unrelated to your CEO job or status. Today, Dom dedicates time to the activities he loves, to running marathons, to spending time with friends and loved ones, and to reading books for both pleasure and perspective on the world outside of immediate business concerns. As a top leader, he's formalized his efforts to stay well-rounded. Dom has developed a dashboard of 16 metrics that he tracks, including several well-being indicators, to make sure that he doesn't neglect his personal life. He may never pick up the French horn or win an award for his Napa Valley-grown Rutherford grapes, one of Ted Hall's more recent adventures, but he doesn't need to. The point is, Dom Barton devotes time and attention to being Dom Barton. He's also made a point of making growth and learning part of his public persona. The mantle of CEO isn't so heavy if you can admit to yourself and others that you are not an all-powerful superhuman. You too have weaknesses and make mistakes. In the cab that day, Ted Hall offered Dom this leadership truth. There are three stages to a leader's career. First, you're known for what you can do. Second, you're known for what you know. Third, people want to follow you because of who you are. This is true of all leaders and especially CEOs. We've seen many leaders, as they get within reach of the CEO role, grapple with what such a role means to their identity, working hard to reconcile the needs of the role with who they are as a person. Craig Barnes, president of Princeton Theological Seminary, for example, told us that as he initially wrestled with whether to take the role, he was concerned that to run an organization of such renown spoke of pride and hubris, antithetical to him as a Christian. Another leader, known for her irreverent humor and spontaneity, was worried that she had to put on an unnaturally stiff mask in the CEO role. Ultimately, leaders who find their own CEO voice authentic to them fare better than those who wear a mask. 3. Find confidants and consiglieri. It's never too early to build a network of advisors outside of your business. These are people who understand what it feels like to wake up in the middle of the night thinking about the hundreds or thousands of employees and their families you're responsible for. They're also people who can offer business advice that's untainted by the authority of your title or their own agenda. Once you've become CEO, myriad helpers will flock to you with advice. Consultants, bankers, lawyers, coaches, and business acquaintances you haven't heard from in years. Overnight, you become a magnet for a crowd of well-wishers eager to help you. You are looking for a small, trusted circle, not an army. The following filters could help you. Agenda. Are your potential helpers free of self-interest when it comes to the advice you seek? If not, are they at least transparent with you and with themselves about their agenda? Where does their agenda conflict or align with yours? Are your bankers or attorneys, for example, telling you to pursue a much larger acquisition because it will quickly make you a market share leader, or because it will bring them larger deal fees? Unless you can have a candid conversation and they are willing to be transparent about their agenda, move on. Chemistry. It's hard to trust someone you don't like, particularly when you are looking for support that's as much emotional as practical. A CEO once told us that she would pick a coach only when she found someone she couldn't wait to spend more time with. Whatever your bar for chemistry is, make sure you feel it with the advisors you select. Competence. Do these individuals know what great looks like? Can they challenge and offer new or broader perspective? Are they among the best at what they do? Chances are by the time you get to the CEO role, you already have trusted advisors. Now is the time to think carefully about whether they are strong enough to take you forward. This has been a Fly in the Ointment chapter by necessity. Sections 1 and 2 of The CEO Next Door focused on helping you land your dream job. In Section 3 of the book, we try to protect you from the common stumbles and explosive landmines you can encounter when you step into the CEO role. We have deliberately focused on what is most likely to go wrong and how to prevent it. With so much to manage, you might wonder if CEOs actually like their work. The answer we heard hundreds of times, yes, yes, yes. Take Madeline Bell. Where she is today looks a lot different from where she was in her first year as a CEO. These days, her life is full of pinch-me moments. For example, a recent public showcase of the hospital's genetic scientists, one superstar after another. In these moments, and I definitely have quite a few of them, I feel very proud and very excited, she says. I finally have that feeling that our board chair talked to me about 18 months ago, excited and really happy to be at the pinnacle of my career. When we asked CEOs about their pinch-me moments in the role, we expected to hear about meetings at the White House, invitation-only gatherings at the World Economic Forum, or flights to private islands on the corporate jet. CEOs thoroughly enjoy the perks and privileges of the role. Yet when asked about their best moments, we heard a similar story from most of them, whether it was a $50 million firm or the Fortune 500. Their greatest moments come when they see their team revel in a victory, and they know that they, as the leader, helped make the team's pride possible. Which leads us to the next chapter. And the most commonly mentioned pitfall of first-time CEOs, choosing the right team. Key takeaways. 1. Congratulations, you've made it. No matter how excited or stressed you feel right now, it's normal. It takes about 2 years to get comfortable in the CEO role. 2. Overinvest in figuring out what you walked into. What you don't know will hurt you. 3. Own your calendar and the incoming requests for your time. Don't let them own you. 4. Get used to life in the permanent spotlight. Smile. It's good business. 5. Use all the levers of the CEO role. If you are seeing the world through your old lens, you are not doing your job. 6. Breathe and get support to help you navigate the trials and tribulations in the CEO seat. Chapter 10. Not just any team, your team. It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. Mark Twain. You probably got where you are today, at least in part, because you've earned a reputation for building world-class teams. In fact, the leaders you've hired and mentored may be a great source of pride for you. You've got committed, talented people who followed you from job to job. You know how painful it is to fire someone, but also that waiting to remove an underperformer serves no one. That's why almost every CEO we meet comes into the role feeling fairly confident about building his team. I've got this, they say. Here's the reality. Challenges building the team are the single most common setback for new CEOs. 75% of CEOs we interviewed made painful mistakes in building their team, despite coming into the role with a lot of management experience. How is it possible that most executives spend their careers thinking they're great on talent, only to pay the price when they become CEO. At this level, the cost of a bad hire is more severe and more public than ever before. Under the spotlight of the CEO position and the unrelenting pressure of running the company, the problem becomes magnified. Take the situation Raj Gupta stepped into in 1999, when he became CEO of the specialty chemical company Rome and Haas, now part of Dow Chemical. Raj came to the United States from India in his early 20s, with $8 in his pocket and no inkling that he might someday have a shot at becoming a CEO. As a mechanical engineer building a career amid a company of chemists, he knew how critical a strong team was. Promoted to CEO from within the company, he knew all the players and had strong instincts about who should stay and who should go. Then those instincts collided with reality. Raj inherited a seemingly intractable problem. What to do about the runner-up to the CEO position? Arthur had been with the company for a long time and was respected for his experience and credentials by the board and employees alike. Raj had grown up in a culture in which firing a guy like Arthur wasn't the kind of thing that one did, especially since the board made it clear they wanted to keep him, Raj recalls. Arthur was untouchable. Visibly disappointed about not getting the CEO role, Arthur became a drag on morale and eventually on performance. Raj resigned himself to live with the problem, finding band-aids and workarounds. Meanwhile, the business was on a wild ride in the early years of his tenure. The financial crisis of 2001 hit Rome and Haas hard. The stock price plunged, the company had to take a major write-off, customers were reducing their spending with the company. A challenging start for any new CEO. To Raj, it felt like professional life or death. Raj discovered, as so many do, that it's easy enough to say you need to get the right team in place fast, but very, very difficult to do in practice. Under tremendous pressure to prove himself, Raj simply didn't feel he had the freedom to move on Arthur. He kept the underperforming executive on the team until the moment that the board called him and said, "Raj, are you going to fire this guy or should we?" Raj not only survived, but went on to lead the company successfully for 9 years. In July 2008, he capped off his CEO run by selling the company to Dow Chemical for $18 billion in the midst of the financial crisis. But looking back on those early talent problems, Raj is clear-eyed. "Did we lose momentum? Did we lose some traction?" he says. "Yes, we did. If I were to do it all over again, I would do it differently." Raj knew the right answer, but felt his hands were tied. It was only obvious, in hindsight, that he could have and needed to move faster. We see different versions of this movie play out time and again. The specific reasons may be different, but the result is the same. "I know it's the right thing to do, but I just can't afford to do it right now." The risk of taking difficult action to make personnel changes feels overwhelmingly real and tangible, while the upside to getting the right person on board can feel ephemeral and uncertain. Team problems cause CEOs more difficulty than board relations, or than any of the five hidden hazards we've already discussed. And if you are reading this chapter earlier in your career, imagine how much career acceleration you could enjoy by getting ahead of this, by becoming adept at building winning teams early on. Approaches we share in this chapter are designed for real-world conditions. While designing that perfect, hand-picked, all-star team the moment you ascend to the CEO role may be a fantasy, you must make necessary talent changes quickly. Successful CEOs we interviewed proactively upgraded up their teams, changing 40 to 60% of direct reports they inherited within the first 18 to 24 months. The first question every new leader should ask when it comes to talent is this: how can I move this from being the team to being my team as quickly as possible? The Inaugural Address. You've heard Jim Collins's enduring dictum, first who, then what. His emphasis on talent is correct, but when we advise new CEOs, we actually flip Collins's advice on its head. It turns out that the best way to figure out who is to start by telling your team what. What do you stand for as a leader, and what does your arrival mean for the organization and for each person in it? Everyone knows a new leader will put her imprint on the organization. A new leader's arrival often brings new energy and builds momentum for positive change. It also causes much anxiety among the troops. As a new leader, you might have barely found the route from your office to the bathroom, but your employees have already spent a lot of time Googling, speculating, and making assumptions about who you are, how you will lead, and what that means to them. Your arrival signals uncertainty and potential threat, which can quickly turn into disengagement and even the risk of losing your best employees. You never get a second chance to make a first impression, and you can bet that the team is watching and interpreting every word you say, every move you make. Under uncertainty, most people assume the worst, shifting their attention from productive pursuits to disaster planning. How you enter the CEO role has enormous power to set the right momentum and tone for your tenure. The best CEOs seize this opportunity to shape the story of their leadership from the first moment with what we call the inaugural address. In 2006, when the legendary Silicon Valley investor Maynard Webb became the CEO of the call center provider LiveOps, his reputation as a demanding leader preceded him. In his prior role as COO of eBay, he was a critical player in growing the company of 250 employees and $140 million in revenue to an over $4.5 billion tech behemoth with 12,000 people. His accomplishments were well known in the tight-knit technology community, as was his hard-charging style. At the time Maynard walked into LiveOps, the company had a young, dynamic team that prized a culture of fun. As Maynard got up to the podium for his first CEO town hall, he was eager to share his vision for the company and his excitement for its future. When he opened the floor for questions, the team had other concerns on their mind. "I heard you worked people hard at eBay," said one of his senior engineers, speaking for many. "How is that going to impact us?" For some members of the team, fear that they would not be able to balance the demands of the job with the rest of their life was eclipsing the opportunity in front of them. While the question surprised him, he didn't back away from the chance to set the tone. "I know you at LiveOps have high aspirations. eBay was a hugely successful public company. We are not there yet. So yes, we're going to have to work hard," he told the crowd. "In fact, we're going to have to work even harder than we had to at eBay. If you don't want that, you shouldn't be at a startup." Courageously, he used the opportunity to announce what he stood for: high aspirations, high standards, and frank realism about the challenges before them. And then he gave them the big finish. "Because we worked so hard at eBay, a lot of people don't have to work at all now, and I hope we can do that for many here." His point was clear. Working hard can get us all somewhere pretty amazing collectively and individually. In this short speech, Maynard had delivered a much abbreviated version of a great inaugural. It is far more than a pep talk. It's a concrete, unvarnished statement of who you are, where you are going, and what it will require to get there. It is too important to leave anyone guessing. Among the key points to consider as you prepare your inaugural address: your assessment of today. What is your take on the current health of the organization? As you reflect on what you have learned about the business, it is critical to show genuine respect for the accomplishments and wins that came before you. It is also important to frame gaps and opportunities. Vivid personal details and examples will demonstrate your connection to the people and the business. Your vision for tomorrow. Average CEOs have a task list. Great ones paint a picture of a point of arrival. JFK's daring challenge to put the man on the moon and bring him back down to Earth safely before this decade is out is aspirational and concrete at the same time. They make the destination crystal clear, specific, and compelling. That's the level you're shooting for when it comes to conveying your vision, a tantalizing glimpse at a future that is both aspirational and supremely concrete. Your values for the organization. What values do you see as essential to achieving that vision? Mary Berner, while at Reader's Digest, for example, committed herself and the organization to 6 principles, with operational efficiency at the top of the list. Your broader view. What do you see happening in the world that will affect the industry, the company, and your own decision-making? Your call to action. Remember Bill Amelio, who was charged with turning around the turbulent helicopter company? He credits an early call to action speech to his senior team with creating the needed momentum. After laying out the severity of the company's financial situation, he said, "We are getting killed in the markets, by creditors, and by the board. We are in a battle together. I need everyone's best ideas and nobody shooting each other in the ass. We're gonna go get this done. You're either in or you're out. Put your hands on the table. If you don't want to be in, tell me and you'll be out tomorrow. Now let's come up with the best ideas we can." Your leadership style. Your people are preoccupied with figuring out how to work with you. Getting ahead of this is actually simple. Tell them. How do you plan to involve yourself in the organization? How will you spend your time? How do you like to be communicated with? We recently worked with a CEO who had a background in sales. When he took the helm of a tech company, the other senior executives assumed he'd be so sales-driven that he'd ignore technical and product constraints and sell things that weren't deliverable. In an early meeting, he reset their expectations. "You probably think all I care about is the New Deal pipeline. It's not. I'll be spending time with the product team and with customers in my first year to make sure I understand how our product works, what we can deliver, and what we can't. I expect you to hold me accountable to that." During your first 3 to 6 months, you'll be delivering versions of your inaugural address many times, in many mediums, to many audiences. Every week, Maynard Webb sent a weekly update to the entire company to share the issues he had at the top of his mind, along with positive employee interactions from the week past. He sent out his objectives, and every quarter he had his own performance graded by the board, the results of which he then sent to every employee. The goal of all this communication was to set the tone that I was very approachable and would share everything I could with them. It also made clear to employees that, as hard-driving as he might be, he held himself to the same standards as everyone else. Your inaugural address prepares the organization for what's coming, but your daily actions must constantly reinforce the message. The 6 safe people bets that put you in peril. You've laid the groundwork throughout the organization for who you are as a leader and what you expect. You know you need to, and you want to, upgrade the team. Yet even the most decisive CEOs often get stuck in the dangerous stalemate of, "Yes, he's got to go, just not now." Certainly, as we saw in Raj's experience at Rohm & Haas, it is never easy to fire people. Organizational politics can create friction and noise. So does pressure. So does the innate humanity of these leaders. The challenges of moving fast on people are real and understandable. But of all these breaks on forward momentum, the sharpest and the most common is fear. New leaders feel vulnerable, and that vulnerability can lead to inertia and poor judgment at the very moment when bold, decisive moves are critical. The problem we've found that is at the core of most CEOs' people mistakes is this. Your human bias for safety is once again leading you astray. The status quo inherently feels safer to us. But this attitude is nothing short of reckless conservatism. Suddenly, instead of taking swift action, you second-guess yourself or cling to your security blanket. People issues are like fish rather than fine wines. The problems you see on your team now are not going to improve with age. If you tolerate underperformance on your senior team, you put your company, your job, and possibly the jobs of thousands of other talented, hard-working folks in jeopardy. And you won't be doing the failing individual any favors either. What follows are the top six miscalculated safe people bets we see leaders fall prey to again and again. 1. Maintain the status quo. Leaders stick with the incumbent team or pull up their trusted lieutenants, clinging to their security blanket without evaluating these loyal soldiers anew for the role. They choose the devils they know. 2. Favor pedigree over relevant track record. Instead of judiciously matching candidates' previous results to future needs, leaders pick the candidate with the most impressive credentials. 3. Acquiesce to the board. Board members, or even a former CEO, often have recommendations on talent. Leaders assume they're stuck with these options and fail to insist on a fully objective approach. 4. Over-rely on people who help them land the top job. A leader ascending to any coveted position often feels grateful to those who helped him win the role. Gratitude and loyalty are essential building blocks for lasting personal relationships. Unfortunately, they can also dangerously cloud hiring decisions. We have seen leaders brought to the point of failure by hiring and keeping people out of loyalty rather than with a dispassionate view focused on capabilities. 5. Hire people who are clones of themselves. People who look like them and have similar backgrounds feel safe to new leaders. So instead of finding people who add diversity and complementary skills to their talent portfolio, so critical to the success of a team, they hire people who are carbon copies of their skill set and experience. 6. Avoid talent that could become competition. Being a leader is hard enough without an ambitious go-getter breathing down one's neck. So new leaders might settle for good enough because the person is non-threatening. This last safe bet may be the worst of all. We recently worked with a first-time CEO who set the gold standard for avoiding the competition trap. Before he assumed the top position, one of his biggest advocates was the head of HR. Everyone, including the board, considered the HR leader untouchable. Nonetheless, he was the first senior executive the new CEO let go. When the HR executive rejected an extremely qualified candidate by saying, "You don't want to hire this guy, he's so good he'll be your rival." At that moment, the CEO realized his HR leader's thinking was incompatible with his vision and values. "I didn't want just one leader who was that good. I wanted to hire 50 people that good," he said. Draft the right team quickly. What follows are 4 fail-safe principles we've gleaned from the CEOs who have avoided the 6 safe people bets and quickly and successfully rebuilt their teams. These are applicable at any stage of one's career. 1. Develop your people plan. In writing. If you are planning an investment in technology, opening a new location, downsizing your manufacturing footprint, or implementing any other significant business initiative. You likely have many pages documenting the business case, success metrics, and implementation plans. When was the last time you applied equal rigor to developing and documenting a robust, no-excuses people plan for the long, medium, and short term? Figuring out who belongs on the team isn't just about assessing raw capability. Building a strong team requires considering three factors. Vision. Does this individual have the specific skills to advance your vision and strategy, as well as the track record to prove it? Alignment. Is she aligned with your values and the direction you are setting for the business? Strong voices and diverse views are essential on any team, but someone who is misaligned on values or doesn't buy into your leadership won't help you take the business forward. Portfolio. How well does this individual complement your own and other team members' capabilities and personal styles? Assess your team looking forward through the windshield, not backward through the rearview mirror. How well suited are each person's capabilities and experiences to what you'll need over the next 1 to 2 years, over 5 years? As a team, do you have the capabilities to take the business into the future? Once you're clear, put a people plan in writing that includes specific milestones and timing, the only way to keep yourself honest and on track. For any team members you are not sure about, write down specific metrics and upcoming milestones that you'll use to make the decision on whether they should stay or go and how to best support them. 2. Starring roles require stars. Tom Monahan is the cerebral former CEO of CEB, a business information services company where hard analytics reign supreme. So frankly, it surprised us when he told us that he learned one of his most important lessons about talent on a beach boardwalk in Salisbury, Massachusetts, where his family owned a carnival business. There were two types of attractions on the boardwalk, rides and games. When it came to rides, the quality of the machine itself drew the crowd, and the team needed to focus on safety and efficiency. Games were another story. Talented carnival callers made all the difference between a hot attraction pulling in long lines of visitors and a forgotten kiosk losing money. Beloved characters, Larry the Gypsy, General Store Jake, were their own attraction. Without top talent in those roles, the carnival couldn't survive. In your business, you need to know where you need a Larry the Gypsy, a top-tier A-player talent, and where just turning on the machine at 11 a.m. sharp every summer morning is good enough. As you consider each position, ask yourself, how important is this role to the delivery of my vision and objectives? Do we need this person to be a source of competitive advantage for our team, or mainly to make the trains run on time? 3. People projects are costly. In the past, as you moved up through the ranks, you could prop up underperformers on your team and still get your job done. Do that as CEO, and you put your company on the line. Every minute you spend putting band-aids on someone else's subpar performance, you are not doing the one job you were hired to do, be a CEO. You no longer have the time, and often not the experience, to dive into the weeds and do others' jobs for them. As CEO, you have significantly less time to run the business as you did in your prior positions. Say you have 2 personnel projects, underproducing staff members, on your team. If 2 of your 5 P&L presidents or general managers each deliver only 80%, you're already way off target for the quarter. We recently saw a CEO lose his job because he kept a weak chief technology officer in a company whose business model lived and died on the quality and development speed of its technology. The business required an extremely talented CTO. The CEO had strong technical chops himself and thought he'd compensate for the CTO's weakness. He was wrong. Key projects fell behind schedule, costs started to balloon, and he was spending less time with customers at the time when his touch was needed the most. Business suffered. The CEO lost credibility with his board, and in 19 months, he was out. The fact that you don't have time for projects doesn't mean you can't have key players who still have room to grow. You want leaders with upside potential. But having too many people projects will weigh you down. People in the most critical roles need to be ready to deliver in the role today, and you don't want to be the only development support they have. Top leaders evaluate the broader executive team portfolio and ask, across the team, do we cover all the critical skills and experience we require? What is the full set of internal and external development support we can engage to perform to full potential? 4. Set a higher bar for what great looks like in each role. You may not always be the best judge of who's a budding superstar and who is a personnel project, especially in areas outside your expertise. A new CEO with a reputation for being smart on talent, Frank, recently ran down his early assessment of his team with Elena. When he got to general counsel, he shrugged. Not the worst I've ever seen. He stays. The general counsel was a 5 out of 10 at best. Frank expected to grow the business aggressively through acquisitions and long-term customer contracts, both of which required a strong legal function. This business needed a 10, yet Frank grossly underestimated the importance of the role. 7 months later, a board member pulled him aside to share his grave concerns about the weak legal team, skyrocketing legal costs, and slow contract execution. Frank, in hindsight, saw these setbacks as costly and unnecessary self-inflicted wounds. He didn't realize how a strong general counsel needs to support the business. Similarly, CEOs, and especially founders of high-growth businesses, often struggle setting their sights high enough for talent needed to take the company into the future, not simply deliver at current scale. McKinney, Texas-based SRS Distribution is among the most successful and fastest-growing roofing products distributors in the nation. Headed by industry veterans Ron Ross and Dan Tinker, SRS delivered a whopping 7.6 times return to investors between 2008 and 2013. Far from resting on their laurels, Ron and Dan asked us in 2014 what it would take from the leadership perspective to triple the business over 5 years and win the talent war. The management team rated themselves as a 6.5 out of 10 in terms of readiness to scale the business. They have been wildly successful to date, but they recognized a new set of capabilities was required going forward. Through a series of interviews and analyses of the entire team, SRS built a talent plan for the future organization that they strive to become. Among other recommendations, this work led Ron and Dan to rethink what they needed from the entire leadership team. SRS continues to thrive, and Ron and Dan credit the lessons in this chapter for giving them a winning talent playbook. So how do the best leaders protect themselves from the 6 safe people bets? They start talent discussions from a zero base. Rather than assuming that you have to live with what you have, imagine you had to redraft your entire team for the sole purpose of winning against company vision and goals. Strip away all the perceived constraints and take a hard look at the future needs of the organization. Reset your lens in terms of the capabilities, skills, and experience you need to deliver the future direction of the business. Only then do you turn to assessing the team to understand fit or gaps. This should become a ritual, not just at the start of your tenure, but every single year. Successful CEOs also don't do it alone. They know when to bring in an outside perspective to push their thinking forward. Asking someone to explicitly play watchdog Testing your assumptions against the facts can help. If there's an area of the business where you don't have a depth of experience, consider bringing in someone who can guide you, as did the CEO with a sales background who, when he took the helm of a tech firm, brought in a trusted CTO from a prior business as a consultant to assess the capabilities of his product team. Finally, you might also benefit from the advice of someone who has solved similar business challenges as a CEO. For example, if you're running a $500 million firm, consult on talent with a CEO who grew a business from $200 million to $2 billion. Build your new language. Another challenge of your powerful new platform is how to stay connected at the right level to your team and to the business. How do you drive the business yet step back enough to get all those people you so carefully selected to do their very best? In the past, you likely added value by being the one with the knowledge and insight to make the big decisions. But the higher you go, the less your value proceeds directly from your insight, information, or experience. We like the way Tom Erickson, who has been a CEO and chairman of several companies, put it, 90% of CEO leadership is behavior modification. Behavior modification is all about getting scores of people acting in an aligned fashion to achieve the goals of the organization. Trust people enough to step back and let them do their job, but also find opportunities to use your presence to keep people honest and on point and to keep them moving. Choose where you get involved based on what signals need to be sent to an employee, to your team, or to the broader organization. The most important decision you'll make is when to be a cheerleader, inspiring and engaging others, and when to wield the hammer of accountability. Each has its time and purpose, and the best CEOs make the choice thoughtfully and strategically, not reactively. Thanks to amplification, the outsized effect the power of the CEO role has on those around you, any suggestion, no matter how gently you deliver it, feels like a pronouncement. The best CEOs deliberately develop their own idiosyncratic repertoire of small gestures that send big signals. Here are a few examples of the symbolic language of CEOs we've noticed. CEO for This Matters. When Tom Monahan was CEO at CEB, he read every benchmarking report the company produced. Every so often, he'd follow up to offer a specific point of view on something he'd read. The point he was making wasn't as important as his sending a powerful message that product quality and customer experience were top priorities for the CEO. CEO for I'm paying attention. When a CEO drops in for a surprise plant visit or walks the halls to smile and shake hands, he or she does so in part to remind people that every single day they have an opportunity to excel or to slip up. And yes, their efforts count. CEO for I know you've got this. You go to the meeting just to listen. John Zillmer, the highly successful CEO of Allied Waste, completely turned that company around. Yet if you attended one of his management meetings, you'd be shocked to see that he often barely said a word. He was present where it mattered, and his silence said, I've got the right people at the table doing the right thing. CEO for We're Discussing, Not Deciding. When former CEO of Arrow Electronics, Steve Kaufman, wants to remind his staff that his participation in discussion and debate is meant to explore, not direct, he literally takes off his CEO hat, it's a baseball cap, and puts on a second hat that says, teammate. Otherwise, when I ask questions, people think I'm giving answers they have to run with, he says. CEO for I Want the Truth. Steve Kaufman doesn't just explicitly ask direct reports to tell him the unvarnished truth. He ensures that bad news travels up to him fast by thanking the bearer and reacting calmly and graciously every single time he's given information, even when the responses aren't what he wanted to hear. CEO for I'm Never Too Busy for You. Mark Tessier-Levine, president of Stanford University, a school with more than 16,000 students, has office hours for students. Through an online sign-up sheet, anyone enrolled can get 10 minutes with the president, with priority given to first-time visitors. CEO for I'm Human. Whether you wear a Hawaiian shirt a la Ted Hall or find other ways to bring your personality to work, people want to follow full human beings, not walking suits. For some CEOs, self-effacing humor goes a long way. After replacing half her team at Reader's Digest, Mary Berner passed out Halloween costumes at a leadership offsite. Her costume? The Wicked Witch of the West. The language of leadership has to do with actions, not words, signals, not demands. Success is no longer your success, it's your team's. Key takeaways. 1. You probably think you've got it all figured out with your team. There is a 1 out of 4 chance that you are right. 75% of first-time CEO mistakes are about not moving quickly enough to build the right team. 2. There is never a second chance to make the first impression. Seize the moment with a powerful inaugural address. 3. Develop your people plan in writing. Use at least as much objectivity and analytical rigor in your people assessment as you use for other business decisions. 4. Know where stars are needed. 5. Minimize personnel projects. 6. Use small gestures to connect with your team. 7. For additional help on building your team, take a look at WHO, the A method for hiring, and PowerScore, your formula for leadership success, both written by Jeff Smart and Randy Street. Alan Foster is a co-author. Chapter 11. Dancing with the Titans. The Board. He is pulling the load of an ox and walking on eggshells. Stieg Larsson, the girl with the dragon tattoo. Joe attended a respectable university, then flew up the management chain of 2 world-class corporations known for 2 things: operational excellence and producing future CEOs. As VP and eventually president, he built a reputation as a lean, mean, operational machine who could rebuild an organization from the ground up. At last, 22 years into his career, his well-deserved shot arrived. When the private equity firm called to offer him the helm of a mid-cap farming equipment company in the Midwest, after hanging up, Joe let out a victory cry in his hotel room. His moment had come. He rolled into town with his trademark energetic intensity, ready to tackle tough changes. The PE firm was confident they had hired exactly the right guy, even though he didn't have a background in farming. To make sure he had the domain expertise he needed, they loaded the board with industry-savvy advisors who could fill any gap. Conditions seemed perfect for a quick win. Instead, Joe discovered exactly what many CEOs find out when they earn that first coveted CEO job: that just running the business is only part of the work. How well you work with your board of directors can make all the difference between success and failure. 6 months in, Joe's board was about to fire him. A typical first-time CEO feels incredible pressure. The group of people whose job it is to hear your challenges and offer wise, dispassionate counsel is the very same group judging your performance. Every challenge you bring them, you rightly fear, is weighted with a question: has this guy screwed up and outstayed his welcome? Boards have the ultimate power and responsibility to give you the CEO job and to usher you out. No wonder working with the board may feel like handling an interpersonal powder keg. Boards are intended to represent shareholders' interests by holding a CEO accountable and supporting her with savvy counsel. They can bring wisdom, experience, and a fresh point of view to push a CEO's thinking and provide a valuable sounding board. A strong board can serve as a periscope to help a CEO rise above the business, above his individual experience, to spot and prevent problems before he rounds a corner. Unfortunately, not every CEO walks into a ready-made, highly functioning board. In fact, only 57% of CEOs we interviewed rated their boards above a 3 out of 5 on adding value to the business. Whether facing a strong or a struggling board, working with the board is the number one concern of incoming first-time CEOs, and for good reason. Failure to manage the board is among the top 3 most commonly cited mistakes made by new CEOs. In our review of over 70 CEO firings, broken board relationships caused a quarter of the dismissals. What starts as a love affair can end as a painful breakup. Once a board gets concerned about a CEO, if that concern is not resolved, on average, it takes boards just under 2 years to move out a CEO. This was almost the case for Joe, our Midwest farming CEO. While he was busy putting his initiatives into motion, the chairman of his board, Keith, was eyeing every move with skepticism. Keith was the former CEO of the company, which he had grown successfully until it changed ownership. The new investor wanted the value of his expertise, but Keith had trouble handing off authority. And so when Joe's sweeping changes ruffled feathers with the old guard, Keith was all too happy to hear them out and conclude that his successor was screwing things up. He began to actively campaign against Joe, providing a sympathetic ear to employees resistant to change and agitating the board to change the CEO. A tireless operator, Joe was consumed by the task of restructuring the company for aggressive growth. He was missing a crucial part of a CEO's job: building an effective partnership with the board. He fell into a trap common for first-time CEOs, in which they assume that as long as they report out strong results, the board will be happy. When we see a CEO struggling with a board, the first question we ask the CEO is how much time and attention she is devoting to building a strong partnership with the board. For many relentless operators, building board relationships is seen as a necessary evil. They are concerned about being in good stead with the board, but don't necessarily invest the time or take the steps required to build a strong relationship. On average, successful CEOs we've interviewed spent between 10 and 20% of their time working with the board. That percentage can go over 30% at key inflection points, such as stepping into a new CEO job, taking the company public, a major M&A transaction, or selling the business. Much like with any other aspect of a CEO's job, allocating time and attention in line with key priorities pays dividends. Joe was the rare CEO who got a second chance. When his board chair aired his concerns to the investors, they asked us to help them understand what was really going on. After detailed interviews with everyone involved, our conclusion was that Joe was the right leader for the business, but had underinvested in his relationship with the board, and that Keith, the former CEO, was a big problem. The investors were the power center of this board. Joe had assumed that as long as he delivered results, they would be in his corner. The problem was that it takes time to deliver results. Joe diligently reported on the project plans and milestones, but he hadn't invested enough, or in the right way, to build deeper trust to turn the investors from watchdogs into allies. He also didn't share strongly enough with them how Keith's meddling was setting the business back and creating morale issues on the team. Absent this deeper relationship building, in the eyes of the investors, Joe was merely a CEO on training wheels, and Keith was the accomplished CEO who had just delivered home run results for the previous owners of the company. It's easy to see that Joe was in a precarious position. We coached the investors and Joe to help them build a deeper relationship. Some of Joe's initiatives were starting to bear fruit, giving investors greater confidence that they'd picked the right guy to run the company. As Joe got stronger, Keith got weaker, and he, not Joe, soon got moved out of the business. 3 years later, Joe had grown the company 50% and doubled earnings, then sold the company in a successful deal. Joe is well into another CEO role now and has been proactively building alignment and trust with the board from day one. Managing the board can feel like a daunting and at times even frustrating task to most new CEOs. The board is an important asset to a new CEO, but it may not be functioning as well as it could. With the advice in this chapter, you will walk into the CEO role better equipped to create the best case scenario. An active partnership with a group of thoughtful, experienced individuals who can push your thinking to help the business and you perform at full potential. How not to do it. CEOs who fail to partner with the board tend to fit one of the following four personas. Super operator. My job is to run the business. As long as results are good, the board will take care of itself. To the super operator, board management is noise and annoying bureaucracy, serviced with a bare minimum interaction. Eager to move forward quickly and efficiently, a super operator soon learns the dire cost of not bringing the board along. Seemingly simple decisions devolve into long, tedious discussions, ultimately blocking progress. The Heisman. I've got this. Heismans have a strong need for both being and looking in charge. They keep the board at arm's length, especially when things aren't going well. As one of the board chairs reflected on a CEO who had recently been fired, he treated the board like mushrooms, kept us in the dark, and fed us crap. That simply couldn't continue. Boards quickly lose trust and tolerate the Heisman CEO only as long as he or she delivers outstanding results. The smallest fumble quickly escalates to an early departure. The Pollyanna. Great, 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 no problem. Eager to score a perfect grade, a Pollyanna avoids the tough, awkward, uncomfortable discussions. Board members are initially happy. It's all good news. But when the cracks show up and Pollyanna glosses over them, the board grows increasingly impatient and distrustful. Pollyannas also tend to overpromise and underdeliver. Their optimism and desire to prove themselves often lead to unrealistic expectations, setting up their team and them for failure. The oversharer. By the way, overly needy for board approval, an oversharer runs to the board with every mundane issue, pulling them so far into the trees that they can't see the forest. Board members can and should help a CEO with perspective, but when lines between governance and management get blurred, chaos ensues. Teams chafe under CEOs who can't work with the board in a way that keeps board members focused on governance and out of daily operations. Who is really in charge? Your first puzzle to solve. What are the power dynamics on this board? Who are the strongest influencers on the board, and how do they wield power? On paper, this is straightforward. The board chair or lead director is often, but not always, the most influential member, followed by committee heads, with governance and compensation typically being the two most powerful committees. And if your company is owned by investors, deal partners generally outrank operators. These rules of thumb are a helpful start, but in practice, the rules of power can be idiosyncratic and unwritten. New CEOs often